Support for this podcast of The Exchange is brought to you by the Dagoba Group, a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice with specialties in unconscious bias, leadership dynamics, and client engagement. Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend. More at thedagobagroup.com.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity. And from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community. With convenient locations throughout northern New England, world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit DartmouthHitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. The statistics will shake you to your core. Manchester Mayor Ted Gatzis said yesterday, talking about the opioid crisis in his State of the City address. And the numbers, whether for Manchester or New Hampshire as a whole, are quite grim. Last year, almost 430 Granite Staters died of drug overdoses, two-thirds of them due to fentanyl or a heroin-fentanyl combination. The rise in opioid deaths and its widening community impact has been sudden in New Hampshire, and yet, with this alarming increase, has come a lot of attention and efforts, from new ways of policing to a plethora of bills at the State House to legislation on Capitol Hill. Today in The Exchange, an update on the opioid epidemic, the trends and hopes here in the Granite State. Let's hear from you. Your questions, comments, personal experiences are welcome at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We have three guests for the hour with us in studio. Dean Lemire, Regional Substance Misuse Prevention Coordinator for Stratford County, who is in long-term recovery from heroin addiction. And Dean Lemire, it's really great to meet you. Thank you so much for being here.
Likewise. Thank you.
Also with us, Tim Rourke, Director of the Program Department and Substance Use Disorders Grant Making for the New Hampshire Charitable Foundation and Director of the Governor's Commission on Alcohol and Drug Abuse Prevention, Treatment and Recovery. And Tim, thank you also for your time very
much.
Thank
you, Laura. Happy to be here.
Also with us, Paige Sutherland, an NHPR reporter. She's part of our team covering the state's opioid epidemic in an ongoing series called Dangerous Ends. You can find all the stories in that series at nhpr.org. And Paige, I know you're busy. Thank you for taking time out.
My pleasure.
Well, Tim, I want to start with you. How surprising are those numbers that I mentioned at the top, especially that fentanyl is now responsible for two-thirds almost of these deaths?
Yeah, I mean, it's tragic, not unexpected entirely. I mean, we've been seeing an increase steadily in overdose deaths over the last few years. You know, this as of March 12th, our official tally for 2015 is 428 overdose deaths, of which 278 involved fentanyl, either pure fentanyl or fentanyl mixed with heroin. That number is expected to even go higher because there are still some open cases from 2015. And we're not seeing that really let up. Recently in Lebanon, I think just yesterday, there was an emergency posted because there were two overdose deaths that were found to be heroin laced with fentanyl. So we're beginning to see that creep more frequently into the state than just pure heroin. And because fentanyl is far more potent, the results of its use are much more deadly.
Well, and we've been talking about this as a heroin epidemic for a couple years, Tim, but we had to change our language recently, right, and say opioids because of fentanyl.
Right. And I think as well, the fact that we still do see the misuse of prescribed opiate medications that is in some ways a precursor to heroin and fentanyl abuse.
So just tell us, remind us what an opioid is.
Sure. So opioids is a class of drugs. They bind to receptors in the brain and really help alleviate pain. So they're used in the medical community. Fentanyl is important to talk about in this instance because there is a version of fentanyl that is used in medicine as a pain reliever in for surgeries and such. However, what we talk about in terms of fentanyl overdoses is fentanyl that is produced by drug cartels on the street and then mixed with heroin because fentanyl is much cheaper to make.
Just remind us, Tim, how sudden this seems. I mean, you look at the numbers over the last 6, 7, 8 years, and it seems like it's gone from, 100 to 430.
Sure, sure. Well, in 2010, we had 177 deaths. So between in the last, 6 years, we've almost quadrupled that. And that's an incredible incredibly dramatic spike. You know, and it's not uncommon to see, you know, one-off spikes one year and a drop the next, but we've been steadily increasing almost ever since then. And in a state as small as ours, that's pretty unprecedented. I mean, the CDC really noted that last year, just in terms of per capita, we had more deaths than any other state in the United States.
Wait a minute. Say that again.
So the CDC looked at deaths per capita. I mean, we're a small state, so 428 deaths may not be much in a state like New York. But in a state like New Hampshire, based on our population size, that's just an enormous amount of people. So the CDC ranked us as having the highest death rate based on population size of any state in the U.S. last year.
Well, and I want to bring our other guests in too, Tim, but one more sort of overview question for you. We are, of course, understandably going to talk a lot about the overdose deaths this hour, but what are the sort of broader community impacts that we're seeing from this sudden rise in opioid addiction?
Sure. Well, certainly also there's the pressures on public safety and first responders in terms of overdose rescues and things like that that we're seeing in our communities. You know, there's been some economic analysis that's been done in the state over the last couple of years to really track the economic costs of addiction, both in terms of public safety and governmental costs, but also to the business community in terms of lost wages, lost worker productivity. That number's at about $2 billion a year. Which is 3% of the state's gross state product. So the ripples impact our society from a public safety standpoint, a public health standpoint, an economic standpoint, and certainly what it's doing to families and safety net providers who are overwhelmed with the consequences of addiction coming through their doors on a daily basis.
Well, and Mayor Gatsas in his State of the City speech talked about the babies. I remember back in the 80s covering a story in Washington, D.C. about crack babies, babies that were born to crack-addicted mothers. And I remember touring a hospital ward, and it was just you just cried seeing these babies. What are we seeing? Are there opioid babies?
Yes. The condition is known as neonatal abstinence syndrome. And I think Mayor Gatsas in his speech yesterday quoted they've had 200 NAS babies born in Manchester hospitals. That number is obviously much larger because we're seeing that across the state. And it's incredibly painful and uncomfortable for the babies. The babies are going through active withdrawal. So there's child protection issues. What's clinically indicated with a baby that's born with NAS is a hospital stay of up to 3 weeks, usually ideally with the birth mother present, because constant contact, physical contact is helpful in the withdrawal. Science isn't clear yet in terms of the long-term implications of NAS because once they withdraw, but the burden is huge, and those babies are in pretty terrible conditions right at birth. It's a really tough way to start.
Well, Paige Sutherland, you're at the State House. How heavily have you seen State House leaders focused on this issue?
Yeah, I mean, as Tim was saying, the stark number of overdose deaths have really created her reaction over at the State House. I mean, this issue has been on the top priority list of lawmakers' minds. You see a number of bills over at the State House to address it. If we're going back to the fall, there was a special session, a statewide opioid task force that was created, some bills that came out of that are signed by the governor and now law. And we have a lot of bills that are working its way through the State House. But as you said, slow moving train, you know, especially bills that have funding to it will take a little bit longer. But it definitely is something that's on everyone's minds over there.
And just remind us, Paige, what was on that fast track? There was a lot of talk about that at the beginning of the year.
Yeah. So basically, there were three bills that were decided to be fast tracked. Only two actually became law and assigned by the governor. These bills addressed upping the penalties for fentanyl, which we talked about is a much more potent opioid that has been leading to, as you said, 2/3 of the overdose deaths that we've seen last year. And so that was part of it. There was another part that added funding for the state's prescription drug monitoring program. There was a bill that basically looked at the overdose reversal drug Narcan to make sure, you know, we're getting those into the right hands, who's using it, how much we're using it. And then there was also a bill that has been stalled and is still in the Senate committee right now about looking to add more prevention in schools from K-12. And that, unfortunately, was stopped a little bit. There was some hesitation in the House about having mandates, wanting local control, didn't want another mandate, you know, burning the schools, no funding attached to it. So those are the bills that passed. And
the state telling the schools what to do without attaching funding. They've never done that before, have they?
Yeah, crazy.
You mentioned resources, and a lot of people say, you know, no matter what side of the aisle they're on, Paige, they say that there's just not enough resources for people with limited health coverage to get the treatment that they need. What's going on the resource side, real broadly?
Yeah, I mean, so basically, we've been talking about this issue for quite some time right now. We're the 49th, Tim would know this better than I, but we're the 49th worst state with this problem and one of the worst states providing treatment for it. So clearly, there's not enough resources out there. There's not enough beds. And the problem over at the State House is we need more money. And when it comes to a Republican-controlled State House, getting that funds, you know, allocated is a little difficult. So, I mean, there needs to be more funds allocated so that we can have more treatment. And a big part of this conversation that has been going over at the State House is getting Medicaid expansion reauthorized. That is a big part. Advocates say that, you know, in order to access the substance abuse treatment services, it's through Medicaid. 7,000 people access substance abuse treatment services now through the Medicaid program. And so if that sunsets, which it's set to do at the end of the year, that will be a huge problem, even cut down on the limited resources we already have for treatment.
Although the House did recently pass Medicaid expansion and sent it on over to the Senate. Is that correct?
Correct. So next week, the Senate Finance Committee will be weighing in and we'll see kind of, you know, the track that it's going. It's going pretty quickly for bills as hefty as this one. But to advocates, this is the bill to really make sure that people who are struggling with addiction get the treatment they need.
Well, again, today in The Exchange, it's an update on the opioid crisis in New Hampshire. We're finding out about the latest efforts to fight this epidemic. There has been progress on some fronts, as we're hearing, but huge, huge challenges remain. And the number of overdose deaths continues to climb. 1-800-892-6477 is the number for you to join us with your comments, questions, reactions, personal experiences with this issue. 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Dean Lemire, I did want to bring you into this. As someone who has personal experience with heroin addiction, what's your broad reaction, Dean, to both the rise in deaths that Tim talked about and the rise in public awareness and political attention that Paige talked about?
You know, it's great that we're getting attention to this issue. It's unfortunately great that we have a primary season, you know, at the height of this epidemic. But it's really sad for me to watch friends die, to watch elementary school friends die, high school friends die, and college friends die. You know, I can look out my window. I mean, I know some of the data regionally, and it's on par with what's happening in Greater Manchester. Just for our small, tight community in Stratford County, we're seeing the same rates of death and overdose as Greater Manchester. But I can look out my window and see human suffering on a scale that we wouldn't allow for any other health condition. I can see, people being woken up by police who have passed out and being carried away for public indecency. I can see, early in the morning, people walking to, their daily work jobs, I don't want to name them, but, and drinking on their way to work. I can see people pacing back and forth, in front of the coffee shops, clearly calling their dealers, and, they need what they need to feel okay in the moment because they're in survival mode. And I know what that's like. I know how that feels. So it's dire. On the other hand, I can also look out the window. I live right near Bonfire Recovery Services, the men's recovery house in Dover. And I can see, because I know these people, I can see triumph over this issue. I can see people in recovery who have a new lease on life, who actually have new lives entirely, who have beat the game, and that's really hopeful. And that's really what I and my job and certainly outside of my job, most waking moments, I'm trying to bolster the recovery side and highlight the triumphs.
Well, and it's interesting you say your community in Stratford County. So for people listening who think, phew, glad I don't live in Manchester and Nashua, I've got my nice little town, you know, with the Village Green, you would say, uh-uh.
No, not at all. And I mean, if you look at deaths by overdose, it's mostly in the rural communities in Hillsborough County. It's everywhere. It's absolutely everywhere. And everyone is a stakeholder now. Everybody is affected. And more people are actually meeting the problem and taking action, which is really cool to see. You know, we have a lot of flared, our emotions. People are personally devastated or just angry by what they're seeing. I get a lot of calls actually from strangers who see my name somewhere and say, I want to get involved in something. I'm angry, you know?
And I want to fix it.
And I want to fix it. Our regional coalitions are growing, monthly. You know, it's cool. As long as all that energy is going towards something positive and that we're doing it together.
Well, I have so many more questions for you and everybody else, but I want to invite our listeners to join us. Lots of folks who want to jump in our conversation already. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And let's go first to Berlin, where Douglas is on the line. Hi, Douglas. Go ahead. Thanks for calling in.
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a group, and I don't know if anyone's ever heard of this. It's called Teen Challenge. Teen Challenge is a ministry that you send their kids to who are involved with drugs, and they go to this program, they get cleaned out. It's actually a Bible-based ministry, which, you know, is very effective. You know, that's where the church can kick in the most, is to be able to see these teens, you know, especially in Berlin or wherever you live.
Okay. Well, Douglas, thank you for calling in. And Teen Challenge, Tim, you were nodding when he said that.
Yeah, we have a Teen Challenge is a national treatment program. They run programs all over the country. They have a program here in New Hampshire. Actually, their program in New Hampshire, even though it's called Teen Challenge, is actually geared at adults and young adults. But I do want to say that one thing that has been great is, I think, the engagement, as Dean said, of broader stakeholders, including the faith community. There's several faith-based treatment programs and recovery programs that are existing in the state. I know the commission that I chair has a recovery task force, and we actually just brought on board in that task force one of the a local parish that is holding faith-based recovery programs in their church. And I think that's an important partner to us in the state.
Well, again, Douglas, thank you for calling in. You're listening to The Exchange on NHPR. Let's check in very quickly with our spring fund drive. So, Tim, picking up on something that Dean said a moment ago, he said he sees people drinking on their way to work. This reminds me of something that you have said. You said, well, it's great. There's so much attention to opioid addiction and prevention and treatment. We forget the bigger picture that we have an addiction problem in this state, whether it's addiction to, you know, alcohol, drugs, whatever. So two questions. Is New Hampshire's addiction problem, setting aside what you're addicted to for the moment, is it worse than most other states?
Yes. Yes. And I think if you look at both, we do a couple of surveys. We do the Youth Risk Behavior Survey that lets us look at substance use rates and a whole host of risk factors with youth. We do something else called the Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance Survey, which is a survey that's done on adults. We also have the National Survey on Drug Use and Health that ranks us against other states in the U.S. You pull all those together and you see that particularly among adults and young adults, we have the highest rates of addiction in the United States, blind to drug. You know, we also have the highest rates of youth alcohol consumption of most states in the U.S. And that's been the history of our substance use experience for the last 20 or 30 years. So what has changed in the conversation has really just been the existence of these opiates and the damage that they do. But we have had this underlying substance abuse epidemic quietly for a long, long time now.
So in a way, we shouldn't be surprised.
No, and I never like to do an I told you so dance, but I think for those of us that have been in the addiction field for a long time, we saw this coming. This, you know, what we've seen in New Hampshire over the last 3 to 5 years, for those of us that have been in the substance abuse field, in the trenches, we knew this was coming. And it's unfortunate, as Dean alluded to, that we're sort of in the predicament now. But to the extent that people are finally paying attention, it is a moment where maybe we can sort of break this cycle that the state has been in for decades.
Cycle of addiction, not just opioid. Let's take another call. And Austin's joining us from Alsted. Hi, Austin. Go ahead. You're in the exchange. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you. I have a two-part question, and the first is I was wondering if your guest could speak to changing demographics of opioid addiction and, if we're seeing addicts become younger and younger, and then also whether or not there's any data relative to the number of addicts who are starting on prescription opioids, whether obtained legally or illegally, and then transitioning to the street drugs, heroin and fentanyl.
Okay, Austin, thank you. And Paige, maybe I'll throw that second part to you. What do we know about how people tend to get started with this?
Yeah, no, I mean, in a lot of the stories that I've done, talking to families, it seems like more than any drug, this is a drug that, has had a different face. You know, it could be your neighbor, it could be your coworker. A lot of families that I talked to said, you know, I never thought this would happen to my son. He went snowboarding, he got an injury, he was prescribed a legal opioid, and then he got hooked. And then, as we know, the story through a lot of families, you know, opioids are more expensive, heroin is cheap on the streets, so it just becomes, you know, they can't afford that opioid anymore. They can't get it. They can't get a doctor to prescribe it, so they turn to the streets where heroin's a lot cheaper. I've heard that from a lot of people battling addiction over at Bonfire. You know, they've had similar stories. They never thought that they would be injecting heroin, and it started off with prescription drugs.
Well, and Dean, our caller talks about demographics, and without giving us specific numbers, I would like to hear from you just sort of who you're seeing in the throes of this addiction. I think our caller is alluding to the fact that it's affecting all sorts of people.
Yeah, so I'm focused on my region, which is Stratford County, and that's a region that's really seeing a push of people who are in need of services, medical, mental, all sorts of services from the other communities like Portsmouth due to gentrification. So we're seeing more of the lower income all the time, and I guess this is something that's been happening since well before I was born. However, I see the higher income, you know. I see the people who otherwise, if it weren't for a sports injury, would never have, you know, totally lost their dignity in their lives because of opioid use. Certainly working at Bonfire, this is like plug three for Bonfire, but I'm proud of them. I watch people, you know, they come in absolutely broken, and then I learn about them, and it's like, even me with my experience, and I'm in, you know, kind of middle class, you know, I've always kind of dressed this way, you know.
Let listeners know that you're very nicely dressed, with the white shirt, you know, the very lovely sweater and so forth. Yeah.
You know, big
hair
glasses.
Slicked back. Yeah.
Sure.
So looking at you, I wouldn't say, oh, there goes a recovering heroin addict.
No.
You look like a clean-cut guy who, you know, works at a high-tech firm.
Right. So I am consistently surprised when I meet somebody and find out that they have an opioid addiction and, in fact, went to IV heroin use.
Well, more on New Hampshire's drug abuse crisis in a moment. Austin, thank you for that call. We'll take more of your calls at 1-800-892-6477. Stay with us. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, it's an update on the opioid crisis. The number of drug overdose deaths was almost 430 in the Granite State last year. We're looking at that and all the ongoing efforts to combat this. There is a lot going on. Let's hear from you, too. The Exchange number, 1-800 892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. With me in studio, Tim Wark, director of the Program Department in Substance Use Disorders Grant Making for the New Hampshire Charitable Foundation and director of the Governor's Commission on Alcohol and Drug Abuse Prevention, Treatment, and Recovery. Also with us, Paige Sutherland, NHPR reporter, part of our team covering the state's opioid epidemic in an ongoing series called Dangerous Ends. You can check that out at our website, nhpr.org. Again, it's called Dangerous Ends. And also with us, Dean Lemire, Regional Substance Misuse Prevention Coordinator for Stafford County, who himself is in long-term recovery from heroin addiction. Again, the number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And Dean, before we go back to our listeners, I did want to turn to you. You were talking earlier about, you know, somebody looking at you, you're a clean-cut guy, you look like you could, you know, work at some high-tech firm or maybe a math teacher at some local high school, you know. How did you get involved in heroin addiction?
Well, I'll have to make adjustments to my look if that's the case, but you know, my story is pretty standard, I have found out, just in talking with a lot of people in recovery who had pretty much exactly my story. Started with, at an early age, you know, around 12, 13, with substance misuse, legal substances. Not for us, given our age, but legal, socially accepted substances.
Alcohol.
And it progressed, you know, and it didn't feel unnatural. It felt like a very natural progression and something that I could justify easily as time went on. It progressed into prescription pill use. Not my prescription, but because it was prescription, I saw it as harmless.
Sure, we hear that. Find it in the medicine chest. The doctor prescribed it. It must be okay.
Right. And really the point was that when I took this, it made me feel good. And that was my whole motive. I wasn't okay. I certainly could have used some mental health services or some sort of attention in that area. I needed to feel okay. And when I put a substance in my body, I felt okay. So it felt totally natural. I found what worked for me. But, you know, eventually my substance use kind of marginalized me in my own life and separated me from the people I loved, you know, and to a point where I had to drink and use every single day in order to get by. And I, you know, I absolutely experienced a total loss of dignity, you know, and it was reduced to one instinct, which was survival. And then even past that, where I didn't want to live anymore. And this is standard. This is something that I see, that I saw at Bonfire when I was a case manager there, just seeing droves of people who looked very dissimilar from each other, had very different backgrounds, but this was their story by and large. And I feel like it's a tragedy that it gets to that point. You know, I feel like we have kind of, as a society, an attitude that specifically heroin addiction is a death sentence. I know from my experience, my own life, and then, you know, helping other people in their recovery, it's anything but a death sentence, that recovery is possible and probable with the right supports. You know, I feel like when a majority of us start to see addiction, any addiction, as preventable, treatable, and recoverable, which it is almost to a person, we won't see stories like mine as often. The epidemics, the waves of epidemics will stop. We will have a system of care that can support people with mental health issues and beginning to have substance use issues.
I definitely want to ask all of you about that system of care for addiction and also mental health. One quick follow-up to Dean's story. And, Dean, thank you for sharing that. We really appreciate it. Tim, here's what scares me is I've heard other people like Dean say you can recover from heroin and, you know, people who are just shining examples of that. What scares me now is that with fentanyl, it seems like, correct me if I'm wrong, it seems like so dangerous that maybe there isn't as much hope for recovery from fentanyl. It just seems like people take it and it's so powerful and they just die.
Well,
is that an exaggeration?
I think there is more risk associated with taking it. And again, in some instances, certainly I have heard from folks in recovery who select to take fentanyl, remembering that addiction is a worsening condition over time. So certainly there are some for whom, you know, as you use whatever the drug is that you become addicted to, in this case an opiate, the same dose you used last week may not work for you this week in terms of that making you feel good, as Dean alluded to. So in some instances, we have folks who will actively seek fentanyl because it provides the better high, and they'll do that absent the risk. But in other instances, people are overdosing on fentanyl and they didn't realize that's what they were taking. So I don't necessarily think that someone who is a fentanyl user has a more difficult time recovering. However, the use has an element of risk in it. But that risk, because some people don't know that's what they're taking, is sort of blind to whether it's heroin or fentanyl in that particular device that's getting it into your body. It's just the nature of that unknown. But it doesn't necessarily mean that it's more difficult to recover from, but the risk is so high.
The risk of you dying is
so high, yes.
Did you want to jump in on that too,
Paige? Yeah, I think a big thing to mention, as Dean alluded to, is when you're in the throes of addiction, you kind of have this one-track mind of just, I need to get high. I've heard so many stories when I've been covering the series for Dangerous Ends just about people who their friend died from a heroin overdose, was laced with heroin, and picked up that same needle and used the very next day. Their friend died from it. It's just you're in the throes of addiction. It's all you're thinking about is getting high. That, unfortunately, you know, 430 deaths doesn't scare you when you have that addiction.
You have a one-track mind. Let's go back to our listeners. And Mike joins us from Hillsboro. Hi, Mike. Go ahead. You're in the Exchange. Thanks for calling in.
Yes. Hi. I'm on MLADAC, working in community mental health here in Manchester. And I wanted to highlight a couple of points that I think are really important. Yes, as maybe has been noted, New Hampshire is close to the top, close to the worst in terms of things like overdose deaths, and not coincidentally near the bottom in terms of funding for prevention and treatment. And there is a mechanism, of course, for adequate funding. It's the 5% law that was passed in 2003, 5% of our revenue from our very lucrative liquor sales are supposed to go to alcohol and drug prevention and treatment, and only about half that money in the 12 years since that law was passed, only about half of that money has made it into its intended destination. The rest has been diverted to meet other budgetary needs. So what we end up doing is working at the problem from the back end, things like Narcan and police enforcement. We really should be working at the prevention and treatment end because there are evidence-based practices that do work.
Well, let's talk about that. Mike, thank you so much for calling. And I want to let you know that Greg in Lebanon agrees with you. He says, I find it unconscionable that as a state, we not only hold a monopoly on liquor sales, but we also advertise and upsell liquor using traditional retail tactics. We then use the profits to essentially keep our tax base low while many of our citizens and institutions suffer from addiction-related issues. Greg also asks, why are the proceeds from liquor sales not entirely devoted to addiction prevention and treatment? We are complicit. What do you think about this, Dean? Or maybe Tim. You want to grab that, Tim?
Sure. fair and important question. And the governor's commission that I chair actually has the authority over the disbursement of those funds when they exist. And so, you know, in the late 90s, there was a decision made by the legislature that if we are going to sell this substance that is a real driver of disorders in our state, that we should take a percentage of those proceeds and put them into solutions to address the damage that overcomes consumption of alcohol and other drugs can do. And the caller was correct that the bill was originally established to take 5% of gross profits and put it into a dedicated fund. It has never been funded at that 5%, absent the first year it was funded. Usually, actually, the formula that developed that fund is suspended and the commission may get a general fund appropriation. In the current biennial budget, the fund is funded through the statute. However, they dropped the percentage of gross profits from 5% to 1.7%. And it's our commission's belief that it should be retained at the 5% or potentially higher. Alcohol sales are recession-proof. Last year, we made about $650 million off the sale of alcohol, and that has increased annually since as long as we've been tracking it. And I think, you know, the challenge in terms of the question of why isn't all of our alcohol sales put towards this issue, and while certainly I would welcome that, $650 million is a big portion of our state budget. And so, you know, and it's unfortunate. I think we are continuing with the commission to engage with the legislature around feeling like the alcohol fund was a smart fiscal policy move on the part of the legislature, and it should be revisited and looked at to establish it more at that 5% level. There is a bill right now, Senate Bill 533, that looks to put additional resources into the governor's commission. It does not name the alcohol fund as the source. Right now, they're looking at lapsed funding within the Department of Health and Human Services. But I think we're continuing to pay attention to that because I do think that while there are very specific reasons from a prevention standpoint, while being a control state is a good thing because we are able to regulate the kinds of alcohol. And while there is marketing tactics, those marketing tactics are not geared at children and things of that nature. However, we think that there is a social responsibility question at play here right now because we do have a funding source. We've had this funding source for almost 20 years, and the state has not availed itself of it to the extent that they originally intended to.
Well, and I have to ask you this question, Tim. When we talk about public funds, including this fund, every time we discuss this topic, we hear from listeners like Mike, who says, yes, we need to devote more funding this resource. People say other resources should be devoted to this. We also hear from listeners who, despite their personal sympathy for addicts, don't feel that this issue deserves state funding. People will often write in or call in and say, I didn't stick a needle in my arm. I've been making the right choices. Why should I now, as a taxpayer, have to contribute to somebody else's mistake? We do hear this from folks.
Well, and I've got really two thoughts on it. The one thing is, as a taxpayer myself, I go back to our economic analysis. $2 billion a year is lost in the state of New Hampshire. This is costing all of us money. Every time your health insurance premiums go up, every time your property taxes go up to put another police officer on the street, drugs and alcohol are behind it. If this was an issue that could happen to an individual in isolation and didn't impact community, maybe you could make that case. But I also don't think – we don't have substantive conversations around reducing Medicaid funding and not covering type 2 diabetes, which is entirely caused by poor diet and lack of exercise. So I think we need to have a real substantive look at not only the fact that this does impact everybody, whether we like it or not, and the fact that this is a disease. And I think we don't make that kind of distinction with other diseases that are caused by poor choices. And in this instance, we know for a fact that choices may be a part of it, but there's also functions that happen in the brain and the wiring of the human body that for some put them more at risk than others.
Well, Mike in Hillsborough, again, thank you so much for calling. And here's an email from another Mike who says, I want to comment on how powerful Dean's comments are and how empathetically he's able to speak about the subject. Michael says, I especially appreciate his comment about people pacing in front of a coffee shop, calling their dealers. He says, as an educator, it's surprising I haven't seen this epidemic personally with my students, but he says, I'll be sure to keep an eye out for more to see how I can help. And he says, thank you for the show. Well, thank you for emailing, Michael. We'll talk more in a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR. Checking in now very quickly with our March Fund Drive. And all of you, let's go back to the emails. There's so many coming in. Here's one from Siri, who says, as a registered nurse working in Manchester, it is astounding the explosion of this problem. I was watching a public service commercial about smoking recently. Smokers who had suffered great health problems due to smoking were giving their testimonials, showing their invitations and tracheostomy. It occurred to me that testimonials from IV drug users demonstrating what they have become and what they look like now might serve as a deterrent for those who might consider going down that road. Siri, thank you for the email. What do you think about this, Dean? It's kind of you're doing this already, going out there and saying, this happened to me, it could happen to you.
Yeah.
It kind of gets to that whole prevention message, too, that our caller was talking about. How do you sort of go out and convince people who aren't in this situation to not get into this situation?
Yeah, I go out, I tell my story. It feels like I didn't really have a choice in it. I just did it, you know. I don't know that I'm trying to convince people of anything. I just feel so compelled that, I'm telling the story of the legions of people behind me who are perhaps suffering needlessly, and many of whom I know personally, who are dying, who didn't get the services or the support or the luck that I had, really luck. This was a survey funded by the federal government. On last count, 23 million Americans self-report that they're in recovery from substance use disorder.
And we don't know how many people are not in recovery.
We do. 22 million. So, as we look at this epidemic, it seems like we're all going to hell in a handbasket, and it's based on a poor choice, a poor lifestyle choice that people are making, and that it's a death sentence, addiction to opioids. And we know that it's not. And when we can make this major perspective change of, oh my God, there's more people in recovery than not, if we can focus our attention to the Martin Sheens of the world rather than the Charlie Sheens, to the people who are successful in their recovery, then we know that there's an answer, this issue really does need a major perspective change. I don't know of any other disease where the major medical societies include the word spiritual in the diagnosis. And for addiction, spiritual is part of it. Total loss of dignity and just spirit, I lost my spirit.
Yank that back?
Connection. I needed to be connected to other people. I was absolutely all alone in my own problem. And I wasn't even aware that other people were experiencing what I was experiencing. I thought that I made bad choices over and over. I thought that I deserved what I got. And now that I have my, most of my mental functioning back, my physical functioning back, and dignity and my spirit, I know that I didn't bring this on myself. I feel like our communities, I don't want to name certain ones, but this issue has taken a spiritual toll on our communities. Otherwise healthy functioning communities are just devastated and hopeless. And you can see the mark of addiction on, anywhere you go in Stratford County, certainly in Greater Manchester. And it all started with a perspective change for me when I realized, oh my God, there's this whole world that I wasn't aware of that I can connect to. You know what I'm saying?
I do know what you're saying.
Okay.
And we'll pick up in just a moment more on New Hampshire's drug abuse crisis, more of your questions and comments in just a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're once again addressing opioid abuse and what's been called the opioid epidemic here in the Granite State. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Your questions, comments, personal experiences are welcome at 1-800-892-6477. Again, email exchange at nhpr.org. And Tim Rourke, I did want to turn to you on this issue that keeps coming up of recovery, yes, services for addiction, yes, but prevention. And the question a lot of people are asking is, how do we best stop people who aren't in this terrible situation from getting into it?
Right, right. And I think, you know, Dean's story is really important to consider, because when we think about this disorder and the opiate epidemic, there are really sort of two camps of origin stories. The first we talked about earlier, which is somewhat innocuous. I have an injury. I go to a doctor. I get prescribed and surprise, surprise.
Overprescribed.
Or I just didn't realize that my opiate receptors were really into this thing and here I am. But Dean's story is the story of a lot of other folks, which is what we say – the more traditional, for lack of a better word, origin story, which is I started when I was 12 drinking alcohol. You know, Alex, who is featured in a viral video telling his story here in New Hampshire, talks about, you know, he just started smoking recreational marijuana and it led him down this trajectory. So the prevention message is so, so important. And it's really about scare tactics don't work. I mean, I know, you know, there's been I know some communities are bringing in, you know, slideshows with pictures of people who are laying dead with needles in their arms. There's absolutely no evidence that that does anything to influence young people's decision making in those kinds of moments. So what we're seeing across the state is the growth of community coalitions and these regional prevention networks, of which Dean is the prevention lead for Stratford County. These are funded by the state and the Governor's Commission with some funding from the Charitable Foundation. The focus is bringing together a diverse group of stakeholders, parents, people in recovery, providers, educators, law enforcement, to look at what are the evidence-based prevention programs and strategies we can put in our community. Those may take the shape of parent forums. I spoke at one in my hometown last night, where you're educating parents of young children about what to look for and how to make sure you're instilling even your 9 and 10-year-olds good prevention messages, and how you manage stress, because we know that stress is a huge driver these days of adolescent substance use. It's bringing in programs like Life of an Athlete, which is trainings, looking at school athletic policies and school policies around how to manage drugs and alcohol, educating young people about not what alcohol use today is going to do to you 30 years from now, but how alcohol consumption on Thursday will impact your athletic and academic performance for the next week. So really targeting very developmentally appropriate messaging and educational programs, while at the same time making sure that pediatricians are asking the question about substance use and educating their patients, that law enforcement has available drop boxes and drugstores are taking back medications, so we're not having access issues where unused prescription opioids are sitting around. So it's that kind of work that is so important, because we recognize – and it's hard in an epidemic like this, because the attention sometimes is – We've got to treat it, and we do. But at some point, we have to shut off the pipeline, and the only way to do that is to make real sound investments in good quality systems of evidence-based prevention.
And what is the viral video, Alex? Just remind us.
Sure, the Partnership for a Drug-Free New Hampshire, drugfreenh.org, has a number of tools and resources and materials good for parents and educators. They did a brief video interview with a young man named Alex, who shares his recovery story very similarly and very eloquently to Dean, who talks about you know, what parents need to do, as someone who really had to engage his parents at the deep end of his addiction to get him the assistance he needed. It's very powerful.
Paige, this education campaign that that Tim is talking about reminds me of what you said earlier, that there was some issue around K through 12 education. Everybody says, yes, 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 prevention. But it's tricky, isn't it, to decide what messages are appropriate, who's going to pay for it, who's going to do it? Is it the churches? Is it the community centers? Is it the schools? They already have a lot on their plates.
Yeah, no, it's a big question, and especially in a state like New Hampshire where, you know, limited government, local control is kind of the driving force here. So I think that, you know, had some roadblocks there in the State House passing where, you know, we should leave it up to our teachers. They know the kids the best. They know what works. They can connect to them. We don't need to mandate this. And what Tim said, and we talked about, you know, kind of at the State House, there's, you know, a number of bills trying to address the overall opioid crisis. But there's also a lot going on at the federal level. We have our senators, Ayotte and Shaheen, who have been acting, you know, as our representation over there on Capitol Hill, trying to get us more funds, you know, when it comes to prevention, when it comes to expanding treatment. They had a big first hurdle that they cleared. It passed the Senate, a bill that would give about $70 million. What if that would go to New Hampshire is still kind of up in the air. But, you know, it includes money for treatment. It includes money to help law enforcement. It includes money for prevention in schools so that we can have those evidence-based programs that Tim was describing. And so at the federal level, we're seeing, you know, action. We're seeing action here in New Hampshire at the state level. So there's a lot of work that is being done. But again, slow moving train.
Let's take another call. This is Alan in Nashua. Hi, Alan. Go ahead. You're in the exchange.
Hi. So in this last period, has there been a change in the criminal structures in New Hampshire beyond the oxycodone to the needle methodology, but some growth or a new gang or just more gangs? What's happening with the criminal structure?
Well, yeah.
Why is this?
It's a great question, and we haven't covered that part. So, Paige, go ahead first, and then Tim or Dean, if you want to jump in, go ahead. Sure.
Yeah, I think that you see it at the State House. There's definitely a change in mindset. I mean, you're seeing lawmakers that are taking on more harm reduction approaches in some of their legislation. We're seeing a big bill basically to give money at the state level for drug courts. That's a new approach that has been going on in the state, but there hasn't been state dollars that have been put on the ground to use it. So this bill calls for $2.5 million that would invest in current drug court programs in the state, as well as ones that haven't existed yet. Like in Manchester, the county rejected a proposal, and Manchester is the biggest hit by this epidemic. So getting a drug court there is kind of essential, a lot of advocates say, to tackling this issue. So we have drug courts changing it. We also have a bill for needle exchange program. New Hampshire is the only state in New England that does not have a needle exchange program. 36 other states have this and have had it for years. So that's a big change in approach. And that bill is facing a little roadblock. You know, it includes decriminalizing heroin residue on needles so that people who are going to these exchanges to turn in their dirty needles for clean ones won't fear that they'll get arrested, because right now on New Hampshire books, if you get caught with a dirty needle, it's up to 7 years in prison, which a lot of people struggling with addiction don't want to take the risk to do that.
I'm glad you called, Alan, because we had not talked about it. And as we're hearing from Paige, there's a lot on that more law enforcement side. Just very quickly remind us, please, Paige, what drug courts are, how they're different. You mentioned that advocates for this issue feel they're really important.
Yeah, so basically, I mean, we can lock people up all day, but the drug court approach is to attack why these people committed crimes. And the big reason is their addiction. We have people who are breaking into homes, going to get prescription drugs from these homes. We have people stealing to pay for their addiction. So really, drug courts tackle the real driver of why they're committing these crimes, and that is their addiction. So drug courts, you know, offer services so that they can, you know, overcome their addiction. It's more of a rehab approach than just locking them up, throwing the key, and then when they get out, they still have the very thing that drove them to be locked up in the first place.
So you're sentenced, quote unquote, to treatment instead of jail time or prison time.
Exactly.
Alan, thank you so much for joining us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. Let's check in quickly with our March fund drive. Did you also want to jump in, Tim Work, on the law enforcement end that our caller raised?
I was just going to say, because I think he was also asking about what we are seeing at the community level. You know, certainly, and this happened nationally, again, as we saw prescription opiates sort of take root and then begin to drop in terms of misuse and abuse, we start to see drug cartels move in to provide cheaper heroin. We've had some significant major drug busts that have hit the media over the last couple of weeks. In fact, some of those have been tied to drug cartels coming out of New York. So certainly we're seeing that kind of activity. And I'm sure in Manchester as well, in particular, which is really the nexus of our major highway corridors, you see a lot of that, you know, gang activity, things that you would describe in a more urban environment than what we're typically used to. The other piece I would say, however, is that in addition to at the policy level looking at penalty reform and some justice reforms, you are seeing law enforcement take some very innovative approaches. I mean, I think the way in which Chief Willard in Manchester and the Manchester Police Department has really come out and to really deeply engage the community in how to create better prevention, treatment, and recovery supports. You have Chief Adams and his Eric Adams in Laconia, which has the Prevention, Education, and Treatment Program, basically providing case management out of the police department when first responders arrive at an overdose, similar to the Gloucester model that's caught a lot of national attention. And we have other police departments looking at that as well. And I think it's an interesting process both at the local level and with some of these state policies like the needle exchange bill, where we're really running up against what does it mean if we truly believe we can't arrest our way out of it. And I think we're going to see that play out at the local and policy level over the next few months.
Well, and Paige, here's an email referring to our conversation a minute ago about federal funding. Christine says our federal reps got funding for health centers throughout the state. She says the health center in Colebrook got over $400,000 for the next 2 years to address these issues up here. We are hopeful today. Christine, thank you for the email. Here's another email that I really want to share with all of you as we close out our show. It's from a person who didn't want to give her name. She calls herself a very concerned mom. She says, I live in an affluent community in southern New Hampshire. My son's best friend is reaching out and is desperate to be placed in rehab. They progressed to heroin after being prescribed sleeping pills. Your guests are absolutely right. This is a challenge that is affecting all communities, and these are real people that we can all relate to. She says, my son goes to bed every night worried that his friend will not be alive in the morning while they are waiting for treatment. I used to hear stories on NPR and feel great compassion, but there's nothing that brings it home like having it happen to someone you care deeply about. We have an obligation to care and provide help. This very concerned mom, Dean, also says, thank you to Dean for telling his story. I feel it's so important to put faces to this and dispel the stigma. And we'll all hope for the best for this person and her son and her son's friend. Thank you for the email. Dean, I did want to ask you, so what's it going to take for the state of New Hampshire to close out this year and say, hey, guess what? Like Christine, our emailer, said, we have some hope. We started bending this overdose death curve in the other direction with fewer Granite Staters, fewer of your friends and people you know, Dean, losing their lives. From your perspective, what's it going to take to move the curve in the other direction?
Well, you know, in terms of overdose and death by overdose, I see this problem actually getting worse before it gets better, you know, as we get our prescription drug monitoring program in place, which isn't fully in place right now. We will actually see an uptick in heroin use, you know, based on the trends that we've already experienced in New Hampshire. These protective factors, the good work that's being done is really going to change the face of how we think about this epidemic and the hope that our communities have. The funding is not there still, and I know that this is a usual case in New Hampshire, that the funding probably won't be there for a while. So our communities are getting creative. And, I'm involved in setting up a network of recovery community centers in my community.
And, Dean, I got to let you go there.
Sure.
But all of you, please come back. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank
this
you,
is The Exchange on NHPR.